Let's give a warm tiger welcome to our speaker.
Well, thank you so much for your invitation to come speak here today. I've never had such an abrupt introduction, but I was so excited I spilled the gravy all over my coat. So, true story. So I do a fair bit of speaking in addition to being in the classroom. I speak to groups a lot. And today, I'm a little nervous. And the reason I'm nervous is because I have two people here that that I don't usually have when I speak. My first one is my boss. Now, I use the air quotes because sometimes, you know, these random quotation marks are really quite annoying. Like, we saw a sign that said a 3-quote egg breakfast. If they're eggs, you don't need the quotation marks. And if you need the quotation marks, it doesn't matter what the price is, right? But my boss is actually the chairman of the Board of Overseers from Stetson University, as well as the Board of Trustees of the entire university, Josh Magnuson, who's there. So I'm a little hesitant. But then I have to tell you that my boss, no quotes, is also here, which is my wife, Debbie. And so, no, seriously, I do appreciate the invitation to speak. And what I'm going to talk to you today about is really a monumental decision from the Supreme Court last term. And that's, of course, what we all refer to as the same-sex marriage cases. The real name of that case is the unfortunate Obergefell versus Hodges. And so Obergefell versus Hodges is the name of the case. You know, the Supreme Court, almost by definition, when it decides a case, knows that it's important. The court only decides about 70 cases per year, so every one of them is important. But as George Orwell said in a different context, you know, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. Well, this case is a little bit more equal than others. Whether you are in favor of that result or not in favor of the result, it made a monumental difference. So what was at issue in the case? Well, what was at issue in the case is there were two questions. One, whether or not the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause of the Constitution require states to allow couples to marry on the same basis, same-sex couples to marry on the same basis as opposite-sex couples. And the second question was, regardless of the answer to that question, is one state required to recognize a same-sex marriage that is performed in another state? And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, ruled that the Due Process Clause and the Equal Protection Clause require states to both recognize marriages performed elsewhere and also to allow marriage for same-sex couples on the same basis as opposite-sex couples. That is just simply a monumental decision. Now, interestingly, I think that that case really literally settles the same-sex marriage question. Yes, it's 5-4, but the court's not going to turn around and go back. I would be shocked. By the way, the next time we all vote for president in 2016, we are also essentially voting for what the Supreme Court's going to look like for probably the next quarter of a century. And the reason for that is, at the time of the inauguration of the next president of the United States, 4 of the 9 justices will be 80 or older. Now, it is true that Ponce de Leon should have looked at the Supreme Court to find the fountain of youth, right? Because the people do not die. But eventually they will, like MacArthur says, fade away, at least, which means that the next president is likely, even if serving only one term, likely to have 4 nominees to the Supreme Court. But even if that's the case, I don't think that this decision is going to be reversed because the court really tries not to do that because of institutional self-preservation, for lack of a better way to put it. So the case, in my view, actually settles this question of same-sex marriage. So it was super important, but I actually think that there are other things that flow from the decision that are going to be more important as we move forward, because they're going to leave a number of things open. So first is this. This was a decision that had exceedingly harsh dissents in the case. And I think those have some ramifications. So first of all, and I rarely do this, I want to read you the end of the Chief Justice's dissent. The Chief Justice says at the end of his dissent, "If you are among the many Americans of whatever sexual orientation who favor expanding same-sex marriage, by all means celebrate today's decision. Celebrate the achievement of a desired goal, celebrate the opportunity for a new expression of commitment to a partner, celebrate the availability of new benefits, but do not celebrate the Constitution. It had nothing to do with it." Now, for non-lawyers in the room, that may sound relatively tame. But that's actually pretty aggressive, because what that is saying is not that I disagree with your interpretation of the Constitution, Justice Kennedy. What it's saying is, you're not interpreting the Constitution. You're making it up. Now, that's a serious charge against a judge. Because if a judge is actually doing what the Chief Justice suggests here, then effectively there's been a coup. And I mean that quite literally. Because an unelected judge has now simply said, this will be the rule. I'm not interpreting the Constitution. This is simply the rule. That actually is quite dangerous, I think, because there is a difference between saying I disagree with your answer and saying you are acting outside of your proper role. Because earlier in the opinion, the Chief Justice actually refers to the five people who are in the majority as a group of five lawyers. He literally strips from them their judicial office. That is, again, profoundly dangerous. And much like children model behavior, other actors in government model this. After this case, the Supreme Court of the state of Louisiana had to enter judgment in a case that was pending before it, that it was holding, waiting to see what the Supreme Court did. The question was whether Louisiana needed to recognize same-sex marriage. And of course, the Supreme Court says, all states need to recognize same-sex marriage. So you would think that the court would simply enter judgment in Louisiana saying, all right, we've been told what to do. The court split 5-2, with two justices saying, I don't have to follow what the Supreme Court of the United States says, because they weren't acting as judges. The Chief Justice said they're just a group of five lawyers. That is really quite dangerous, in my view, as we move forward. That will have implications. Second, and now I'm going to put on my law professor hat for a second. Don't worry, law professors are actually very exciting, despite what you've heard. from my wife. I spend a lot of time trying to convince my students that they can disagree without being disagreeable, that their reputation is important, that they have to treat one another civilly when they go out, because our profession breaks down when people do not act with civility. It is exceedingly hard for me to do that when some of the dissents in this case are like the sentence I'm going to read to you now, Justice Scalia. This is what he wrote in an opinion, published. "If, even as the price to be paid for a fifth vote, I ever joined an opinion for the court that began," and then he cites the first line of the majority opinion, quote, "I would hide my head in a bag." First of all, I have no idea what that means, but second of all, that should never be in an opinion. He then goes on to call Justice Kennedy egotistical? I mean, literally refers to him as egotistical, and that's the pleasant part of the opinion. It's really hard for me to, with a straight face, say to my students that they have to be civil in a deposition when nobody's watching other than the people in the room. When it's okay for an associate justice of the Supreme Court to treat colleagues like that in writing. Right? That shows you that the fabric of how our institutions fit together may be fraying. Just compare another monumental decision with this one, Brown versus the Board of Education. In some ways, they're very similar. Right? Groups fighting for a civil rights fight, and then the Supreme Court makes a ruling. And everybody knows it's super important at the time, right? They sound very similar. Of course, Brown versus the Board of Education was unanimous. Matter of fact, it was signed, literally signed, by all 9 justices of the court. That's exceedingly rare. They were unified. Now, that was largely due to the work of the Chief Justice at the time, Earl Warren, but this case was not unified. Now, that doesn't mean I think that the result's going to change, as I said. It's not going to change. But it does tell you that there is this division that I think in the long run can be very dangerous to the government. And I think that's something we're going to be experiencing. But I also think that what this case has done is opened up a whole new set of questions that we're going to have that go far beyond sexual orientation. Because we just can look and see what some people are doing in response to this decision, which does raise, I think, some very interesting questions. So, 2 hypotheticals. On the one hand, we have a clerk of court, whose job it is to issue marriage licenses. And she, this is in Kentucky, has refused to issue marriage licenses because she has determined, I thought I was violating one of your rules. I confess to you that I have a small fear that if I don't follow the rules precisely, a small tiger is going to come out from behind here. And this tiger could take me out. So the clerk has refused to issue marriage licenses because she claims that doing so would violate her firmly held religious belief that this is bad. On the other spectrum, our other hypothetical, assume that you're a baker, this time in Colorado, and you refuse to bake a cake for somebody because they're a same-sex couple. Because of your religious beliefs. Right? We are going to have to confront how we balance our desire to protect religious liberty with a whole number of rights, whether it is the provision of contraceptive services, right? Whether it is certain types of speech that we allow, whether it is performing same-sex marriages. These are issues that are now really going to be at the forefront. Now, some of them are easy for me, right? I think the situation of the clerk is simply easy. I actually don't think that raises a religious point at all. Because if you decide to be a member of the government, you simply have to perform your job, right? That, it seems to me that's that easy. And just think about this for a moment. Assume that instead of being a firmly born-again Christian, as the person in Kentucky is, assume that the person is a Buddhist who believes that all living animals have a soul. And so he or she refuses to issue a hunting license. Right? We know what would happen. All of the people now who are saying, of course you can do that, would say, are you kidding me? And then substitute it in anything else you'd like, right? I am a pacifist because of my religion, and I will not issue you a gun license for self-defense with a handgun in your home, something that the Supreme Court says is clearly within the ambit of the Second Amendment. These are going to have profound implications as courts consider this. And then if we turn to the baker, that gets complicated too. Right? Now, you might think that the baker's question, which I think is closer, is one that might be answered by looking at the First Amendment, freedom of religion, right? The free exercise of religion. Here is a secret for you. Since 1990, the free exercise clause of the First Amendment has been almost entirely meaningless. It literally has almost no meaning. Now, why? Because in 1990, there was a man named Mr. Smith. And Mr. Smith, as you'll understand in a moment, ironically enough, was a drug counselor in a prison in Oregon. And he popped positive on a drug test. And he was fired. And he sought unemployment compensation and was denied because of an Oregon state law that said, if you are fired because of the use of drugs, you do not get unemployment compensation. And he sued and he said, no, that law's no good as applied to me because I am of a Native American religion. And as part of my religious ceremonies, we smoke peyote, a form of marijuana. And just like, say, Roman Catholics would drink wine as part of the ceremony, that's what we do. And so you can't say I can't get unemployment compensation because of that, because of my free exercise rights. And the Supreme Court, interestingly, in an opinion by Justice Scalia again, said, no, actually the state can do that. Because what he said is, if your religious exercise is affected by a law of general applicability, then all what the government does has to be is rational. The government has a legitimate reason for acting, and what it did was rationally related. Because if it's a general applicable law, we're not really concerned. Now, think about that, because most effects of religion that you're going to have are because of generally applicable laws. Now, the free exercise clause can still come into play, but only if you're targeting a religion. So, and I just like to say this because of the name of the case. It's a case called the Church of Leukemia Babluai versus, I love that, against the city of Hialeah, Florida. And there was a group in that city that was Santeria. It's a Caribbean religion that blends Caribbean beliefs with Roman Catholicism and involves the ceremonial slaughter of chicken. People didn't like that, so the city said, no killing of animals in the city limits. Sounds like a law of general applicability. But then the Jewish slaughterhouse says, whoa, you know, we gotta kill our cows in a certain way. And the city says, oh, of course you do. And they gave them an exemption. And then they exempted everybody. So the law eventually read, if you're a Santeria and are going to kill chickens, don't come to Hialeah, right? And it goes up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, of course the First Amendment protects that, right? But those are really rare. So in fact, this question about whether or not the baker can assert his or her religious belief is actually not going to be a constitutional question. It's going to depend on statutes, like the one that was at issue in Indiana, right, that says you have a right to not serve people if it affects your religious belief. So the courts are struggling with how to balance those state protections of religious belief with this idea that somebody has a right to do something else. And that is, I think, in the long run, what this case does, because it closes the door on this idea of same-sex marriage rights. I think there'll be pockets of resistance, but they're going to go away. But it opens up the door on this idea of how we balance religious belief in the United States and then the rights of others. And so my prediction is over the next 5 to 7 years, you're going to see a lot of litigation on that front as the Supreme Court figures out how to balance these different values that we put into our Constitution. And so this is perfect because I just got my 1 minute sign. So with that, I'm going to say I'm glad I avoided the Cubs and thank you for the invitation.
Yes. Oh, I'm not going to pick you. Hold on a second. Please remember to form your questions in the form of a question. 45 seconds, no speeches. And you're going to pick on the questioners.
Okay, yes.
Say your name.
Judy Hunt. Setting aside the Constitution for a minute, now that all of these justices are making decisions based upon politics, shouldn't they stand for election like every other politician?
I don't think that they're making their decisions based on politics, so I think there's a false premise there. But I actually think we balance two different things here, right? On the one hand, we balance independence and accountability, right? So if you think about it, our state court judges are exceedingly accountable, but less independent because they have to stand for election. On the other hand, our federal judiciary is very independent and correspondingly less accountable. And so the question is, what's the right balance in those particular situations? I actually think our Supreme Court is not political in the sense of right or left. I think they are political in a good way, in a sense, which is thinking about the implications of their decisions. But I actually don't think they make decisions based on politics. I just think they have very different views of either the role of a judge or the role of the Constitution. Yes, sir.
Tom Dunn. Tom Dunn. Do you believe Bush versus Gore was a coup?
No, I don't. In one sense, I think that that was an exceedingly wonderful example of American democracy. And I'll explain a little bit within my 2 minutes. Because Bush v. Gore has a special place in my heart. Because the day before, the weekend before that election in 2000, I was with my wife and my then one child interviewing for the job that I now hold in Washington, D.C. I then got a call back and flew down here the weekend after Bush v. Gore, after the election, and then told my law firm, or somebody at my law firm, that I was leaving because I had gotten the job on the day the Supreme Court issued its decision. Why I tell that story is this. In that period of time, I never for a moment thought that I'd open the windows of our house, the curtains of our house in Boston, and look outside and see that Bill Clinton had called out the troops to put his vice president in. Because the Supreme Court had the case and we were going to follow what it was. That is a remarkable point about the rule of law. I think the Supreme Court felt in Bush v. Gore that it could not allow that to go on, and it made a call. Right, so I actually think that Bush v. Gore is something that in the law we would call sui generis, which means one of a kind. It was a decision for one moment in what the court thought was right, and I actually think, strangely enough, it is an example of excellent American democracy. Yes, sir.
Jim Gillespie, do you think the domestic same-sex marriage case will require the court to create a hierarchy of constitutional values, and by doing so, increase the intrusion of the federal government into what are supposedly state rights? Because matrimonial law or domestic relations traditionally have been within the state's purview.
No, I don't. I think that so federalism is a two-way street. Right. We use the term today in a way that people think when you say something is about federalism, you mean the state gets the right to do something. Well, actually, federalism is some things are federal, some things are states, and when they conflict, the Constitution tells us federal wins. The core value of the Constitution is there are certain things that prohibit government action, including state actions. Here, the example would be the interpretation of the Due Process and the Equal Protection Clauses. And so, I actually don't think this is actually about marriage regulation. I don't think Congress would have the authority to pass a law, for example, establishing a national marriage registry. But I think that the federal, quote, federal constitution actually does bind the states in terms of saying what they cannot do, i.e. deny to any person within their jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Because after all, you don't need a constitution to protect a majority. By definition, you need a constitution to protect a minority. And that's what the Supreme Court majority rejected, because the one state interest that was asserted to justify same-sex marriage bans was democracy. Our citizens voted for it, and that's our interest in preserving it. But that is a crazy, no offense intended, my younger son likes to say that. He could say, he says you can say anything you want to somebody as long as you follow it up with no offense, right? It's crazy, and the reason it's crazy is because a constitution only is necessary to protect the minorities, not the majorities. Yes, sir.
Steve Gellin. Many companies and governments implement domestic partnership registries in order to afford insurance and other benefits to the same-sex long-term partners of their employees because these couples were not permitted to marry. Since Obergefell, some companies have now entered the registries and the benefits. Are these domestic partnership registries now unconstitutional as applies to heterosexual couples in long-term relationships who are not eligible for employee or dependent benefits?
Okay. Excellent off-the-cuff question. So let's take it in two parts. As to companies, right, with one exception, the only people who can violate the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, are government actors. Right. The one exception to that is the 13th Amendment. Nobody can own slaves or hold anybody in involuntary servitude. The Constitution binds us for that. But other than that, it doesn't. So, for example, at Stetson, which is a private institution, I could walk into my class and say, I am only teaching the men. I would like the women to leave. Right? And take off your shoes and be barefoot on the way out. Right? I could do all of that. And I would have violated all sorts of laws, but I wouldn't have violated the Constitution because I'm not a government actor. Interestingly enough, if I were a professor at the University of Florida, a state school, I would have violated the Constitution. So nothing in Obergefell can make something that a company does or doesn't do unconstitutional. In terms of governments, I don't think that it makes domestic registries unconstitutional. In fact, much for the reason you suggested, sir, if a state wants to create a parallel to marriage and give all couples the choice, you can be married or you can go to a domestic partnership, that's still okay. What I think Obergefell makes really clear is whatever would be done for the opposite sex couple has to match what's being done for the same sex couple. And so you couldn't say you only get the registry, but you could give people the idea of that. So states that give people the option to do covenant marriage, for example, that would have to be provided to same-sex couples too. Yes, sir.
My name is Jim
Farron. Oh, yeah, he just joined today.
I just joined.
Okay. There are rules.
There are rules?
Jim Farron. Can you speak a little bit, or what would you see as the issues on same-sex equal partner marriage with regard to adoptions and custody battles and divorce? Because right now, I believe it's a little difficult for the adoption process for equal same-sex partners.
So I think that they're all going to fall, right? Because there is almost no way that the government, in my view, can come up with a justification that would say that it is even rational to treat the couples differently in that respect. Indeed, in Florida, even before the Obergefell, we had, of course, a ban on same-sex marriage in Florida, but the ban on same-sex adoption had been struck down and the state did not appeal that, and so our ban on adoption went away. So I very much doubt that though any justifications like that are going to continue at all. Now, the key is this. The real question for me is, how much are states going to fight? Right? Because technically, if a lawsuit is really, most lawsuits, unless it's what's called a class action, is one person against another, right? So you got two same-sex couples, say, that sue the clerk that say issue the license. In theory, that decision that says issue the license applies only to those two couples. And if a state wanted to be, the technical term would be a jerk, right? What it would say is it would make every same-sex couple file their own lawsuit, have a court issue, the state would be able to appeal, and that would take time. So it's just a matter of time and how much the states are going to fight on that, I think. Yes, sir.
This one is off the cuff. I was just thinking about what you were talking. So, Leonard Schmigge. So if a gay couple has been together for 30 years, mm-hmm. are they considered under some jurisdictions as, what is the word, palimony? And so if they separate now, are they considered as having been married and then you go backwards? Or are they grandfathered in from today somehow?
So the real answer to that question comes from my younger son, Noah. Noah, when he was, now I really do love my son Noah very much, but he is in some respects like a devil child at times. And when he was a younger child, we would look at him on those rare occasions my wife and I got a babysitter, and we'd look into his little eyes and we'd say, "Are you going to be good for the babysitter, Noah?" And he'd look at us and he'd say, "Who knows?" Right? And I have learned over the years how profound that was, because the real, you notice, right, that is a question. So if you lived in a state in which you did not, you could not by definition be married, and then all of a sudden you're in a place where you can be married or have a relationship that the law will recognize, do you go back in time? And this can have serious ramifications if you're in a state that still recognizes common law marriage. Now, my sense is that the way this is going to be done is that when there are benefits that flow from saying, let's reverse course, courts will be inclined to do that. When it's being used as a weapon, say, between spouses who are saying, aha, I get everything because, you know, it's a common law marriage, I suspect courts won't do that. And so I think that there are going to be family law issues that are going to have to be wrestled with trying to figure out precisely that question. It's easy going forward, much more complicated going backwards. So I think that that's a very good question. I didn't mean to influence people who are writing down their questions.
We can't be influenced.
We can't? Oh, well, there you go. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
My name's Gary Stempinski. I'm going to give you a fun question. We're going to project the election for 2016. And let's pretend that we have a conservative Republican that gets elected. Now he has appointments from all the way out to the year 2020. In the year 2020, the Supreme Court's going to change. What is your projection and what's the outlook for the current law?
Okay, so assuming that a relatively conservative Republican is nominated. So right now, our court is exceedingly closely divided. So last term, for example, 26% of the cases they took were 5-4, right? That's a big number, right? But the court is not balanced. And what I mean by that is it is a rightward-leaning court, in the sense that Justice Kennedy is the middle justice, and he is on the right of the spectrum, right? So if there is a Republican that's elected, the court is actually going to continue essentially in the way it is, probably moving a little bit more to the right, depending on how long Justice Kennedy stays. But the dramatic shift in the court would be if a Democrat wins, because the justices who are older, are going to be over 80, right? Two of them are one of them is very conservative, and the other is the middle justice, Justice Kennedy, who's the most important one. So I actually think that there would be, it's going to be super important if a Republican wins, but super, super important if there's a Democrat who wins, actually.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Victor DeMaio, Vice President of Tampa Tiger Bear Club and a member here as well. So I really do have to differ with your analogy that the court is not political, because you just now just said the difference between the Democrat and Republican president of appointee power will shift the power of the court. So how can you say that the court's not political? I'm not an attorney. I'm not as smart as you. But I just, but I really, I mean.
You should have seen my wife's face on that one.
It drives me nuts when people say that the court's not political, when you have a Clarence Thomas who's clearly, he may not be political in the Republican sense, but he's definitely conservative. And that's really where the Republican Party lies as opposed to the Democratic Party. So how can you sit there and have a dichotomy of answers?
So, because I think that this is a problem with words, all right? Because if one uses the term political to mean partisan, right, to mean it this way, I'm a Democrat, so therefore I am going to pick up this, I'm going to vote this way because that's a good for Democrat, right? I think the fundamental divide on the court when we talk about being conservative versus liberal as it relates to the Constitution is actually a matter of interpretation, constitutional interpretation. If you are a, quote, liberal on the court, you are willing to be more pragmatic and use lots of different sources to help you interpret what the document means. If you are conservative, what you do is you search for historical evidence of, say, what something meant in 1789. And if you find something that gives you cause to believe that, then that is simply the answer, regardless of anything else. That is a divide. Now, that doesn't always, though, translate, interestingly enough, into results that would be thought of conservative versus liberal. One quick example, because I know my time is going. Helicopter flies over a house. The police think the house is a grow house for marijuana. They don't have enough evidence to get a warrant. So they fly over the house. They use heat-seeking infrared devices to see the heat that's coming. It shows a lot of heat. So what do? They use that to go get a warrant. The homeowner says, no, that's an illegal search of my house. The Supreme Court decides 5-4 that in fact it is, and the criminal wins. The dissent was Justice Stevens, a liberal. The majority opinion was written by Justice Scalia, the conservative, because he said, you know what? This is meant to protect the house, and that's what happened here. So that's what the divide is, I think. All right, well, thank you. Is that how I end, or does...
Stay.
Okay.
Usually I have to cut them off, and they're just not as on top of things today. Okay, but now we're going to wait for the Fang and Claw winner so you can present it. Because they didn't have any warning. Usually they have some warning. Huh? Oh, programs, yes. Okay. All right. I knew I was supposed to do something on there. On September 14th, we have Representative Daryl Roussan coming to talk to us at Banquet Masters. I'll repeat, Banquet Masters, not the Yacht Club. And I don't have the rest of them.
David Jolly, October
David
5th.
Jolly, oh my God. That was excellent.
Where?
That's very good.
Banquet Masters, corner
Banquet
of 49th
Masters.
And Overton.
Did you fill out a membership card? Yes. Okay. All right. Our Fang and Claw winner for the question about a retroactive approach to same-sex marriage and looking back 30 years and palimony and all of that, Leonard Schmiege.
And so what do I give Leonard?
You're going to give Leonard this. And I forgot to...
You're late.
in my position today.
You look terrible.
Wow.
They're small, but they're fierce. I have to present you with our covenant.